And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us is Trent from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, you know, a few inches of dense wind-driven snow can go a long way for our weathered snow surface out there in the backcountry. Riding and turning conditions will improve today and into tomorrow as a few more inches of snow stack up. However, with that new snow comes a lot of wind. The winds across the highest peaks right now are just ripping into the 40s, 50s, and 60s. If you get out of that wind elevation zone, it's still moving 15 to 25 miles per hour, gusting into the 30s across many of our mid-elevation ridgelines. You know, unfortunately, our snowpack just can't take a lot of weight. And with each loading event, we see our persistent slab dragon come back to life. And it really won't take a lot of weight to reactivate this beast. And if you look back just a little while to January 26th, where we had just a few inches of snow, it was enough to cause human-triggered avalanches. So our weak and fragile snowpack just can't handle a lot of weight. For today, we have a bottom line of a moderate avalanche danger for triggering one of those persistent slab avalanches I just described. Those are going to be mostly found on slopes that face northwest to east above 8,500 feet in elevation. And the most suspect slopes will be the ones that are getting loaded by wind and new snow today. Human-triggered avalanches 1 to 3 feet deep are possible. Additionally, with those winds, we have shallow pockets of wind-blown snow that'll be found along the upper elevation terrain features and will be most problematic in high-consequence terrain. So that about does it. I would urge your listeners to always check UtahAvalancheCenter.org if they're heading out to the mountains. And I think the snow conditions will get fairly good by Tuesday, Wednesday.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much. It's 8:11 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Utah legislature begins its third week today, and on the phone with a recap from last week as well as a look ahead, I have the managing director of UtahPolicy.com, Brian Schott. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So this week is an important budget week. Tell us what needs to happen this week.
Well, it's kind of an important budget week. Lawmakers have to pass what's known as the base budget by tomorrow. And base budgeting, it's a process they put into place during the Olene Walker administration. And the reason why is one year they had passed a budget or had gotten a budget ready to go, and Governor Walker demanded an extra $15 million put into the budget to pay for a reading program that she wanted. And that resulted in a little bit of a standoff. She basically threatened to veto the budget and then bring lawmakers back into a special session the very next day. They didn't like that idea very much after being up there for 45 days. They relented, gave her the money they wanted, but the very next year they passed a process called the base budgeting, where what they do is they set a budget, a base budget, that if something goes haywire with the regular budget, or if the regular budget gets vetoed, then they reverse back to that base budget. So it was just an attempt to keep the governor from holding the budget hostage, or the House holding the budget hostage against the Senate. It basically took that off the table, and then they would have a budget moving forward, and then they could go from there. They have to pass that base budget by tomorrow. So all of the appropriations committees are finishing up their work. They've been instructed by the Office of the Legislative Fiscal Analyst, who has identified about $160 million in cuts to the base budget, you know, programs that maybe aren't performing as well as they used to, money they could put elsewhere. Nobody's really taking that $162 million in actual cuts seriously, because lawmakers do have about half a billion dollars extra to spend this year. So why are you cutting if you have all this extra money? So that's sort of one of the tensions that's going on up here. Once they pass that base budget, then they'll get on to the process of actually setting next year's budget.
Okay, which usually happens midnight on March 8th.
No, they actually pass it a couple of days before. It's what they call the Bill of Bills. They just hammer out what they want to spend things on. You know, they'll allocate a certain amount of money, like House Democrats will get a certain amount of money to fund their programs. Senate Democrats the same way. House Republicans, Senate Republicans, all the caucuses will get certain amounts of money to allocate towards programs. So all of the appropriation requests had to be in at the end of last week. So if they're trying to spend new money, those had to be in, and then the Executive Appropriations Committee will go through and start to prioritize those. Each one of the caucuses will also prioritize what they're going to spend money on, and those negotiations will go forward until the very end. But then they'll finally pass the bill of bills, which is the main budget, and then any supplemental appropriations bills right about a day before the end of the session.
Okay. For the second year in a row, we have seen a record number of bill requests. Is it because it's an election year? Lawmakers kind of want to show that their constituents that they've been busy?
Well, maybe, but I also think that it's just the natural expansion of government. There's a lot of things to cover up here. You know, technology is advancing extremely quickly, and legislature's trying to keep up with that. Issues pop up that lawmakers want to address. They'll have constituents approach them about a bill. Now, what they're saying is those are bill requests. They had about 1,340 bill requests. That doesn't mean we're going to actually see legislation from that. That just means they've got legislative lawyers starting to work on that. And, you know, a lot of these bill requests, if someone had a bill request in process right before the session starts, that's probably not going to get done. Lawmakers can prioritize bills. I think they can prioritize three of them. And then it's just first come, first serve from then on. So, yeah, there's 1,300 bill requests. I would anticipate somewhere around 900, 950 of them will actually get introduced into the process. And then lawmakers will end up passing somewhere between 400 and 500 of those.
Okay.
Which has been par for the course of the last few years.
Sure. UtahPolicy.com had an interesting report late Friday. Basically, rather than letting the public initiative process go off with the Our Schools Now initiative, a bill from Representative Schultz trying to kind of preempt that. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, that's not the only report that we had. We also had one about the medical marijuana initiative, and I'll go into both of those. The one about Our Schools Now, Representative Mike Schultz, he is proposing a funding boost for Utah schools in his bill. If the bill passes, it would also roll back any tax hikes resulting from the Our Schools Now initiative. He believes that raising income tax and sales tax to produce the $700 million annually of funding for schools, which is what Our Schools Now is trying to do, he believes that will have a detrimental effect on Utah's economy. It will slow down growth. It will slow down spending. And that will, in the long run, actually hurt the state while helping schools a little bit. So, you know, lawmakers don't like this idea of the of a tax hike being imposed at all, and they don't want the citizens to do it in outside of them. So that's one of the things that they're trying to do. Some people are speculating it might bring Our Schools Now to the bargaining table to try to work out a compromise. Our Schools Now tells us no, they are too far along in the process gathering their signatures, so they plan to be on the ballot. I don't know if this bill is going to go through, but it certainly doesn't look good that lawmakers are trying to head that off. And on top of that, earlier this week, we broke the story that lawmakers are trying to consider some measures to head off the medical marijuana initiative, and that has now been confirmed by other outlets. One of the things that we're hearing that they're trying to do is the same thing they did with Count My Vote back in 2014, which resulted in SB 54. During that whole process, Senator Kurt Bramble threatened to take the language from Count My Vote, put that exact language into a bill, pass the bill with maybe one or two tweaks that would keep it from going into effect. And then if Count My Vote went ahead with their initiative, they would already be passing language that was in state law, so the initiative wouldn't do anything. That's one of the things that they are contemplating doing with a medical marijuana initiative, taking all of the language that's already in the medical marijuana initiative, placing it into a bill, and passing it with one change. And what that change would do is say that it would not go into effect. So the lawmakers would pass a medical marijuana bill, but it would not go into effect until the federal government reclassifies medical marijuana, medical cannabis, as a Schedule IV drug, which is the same thing as Xanax, Ambien, you know, drugs like that. Right now, medical cannabis is classified as a Schedule I drug, which is the same thing as heroin and cocaine and LSD. So needless to say, even though the state would pass medical marijuana bill, it would not go into effect for years down the line. So those are some of the shenanigans that lawmakers are thinking about doing with these citizens' initiatives. They don't like them. They don't like what they do, and they're trying to head them off. They've done this once before. Way back in the 90s, there was a citizens' initiative that was going to impose term limits on the legislature. Lawmakers went ahead and passed their own term limits bill, and that basically stopped the citizens' initiative in its tracks. Right before that term limit bill was supposed to go into effect, lawmakers turned around and repealed it.
It just doesn't seem right, though. I mean, it just seems like they're getting in the way of, you know, what citizens want.
Well, they are. The argument is citizens' initiatives are very broad. They can have a lot of unintended consequences. A lot of lawmakers have told me that the medical marijuana initiative is written very poorly. And if you look at it, there are some problems that it does have. One of the problems that they point to is the fact that there is no rulemaking authority given to any of the agencies that would be in charge of regulating medical cannabis or the growers or getting it to actual patients. And so what would have to happen is any changes, if something were to go haywire, if there were an unintended consequence in this bill, it would have to come back to the legislature to fix, rather than giving the agency that's in charge of it the ability to fix that. So there's no rulemaking authority in there, and that, they say, is a flaw to it. There are a few other flaws that they don't like, but do not forget, these citizens' initiatives, they're not constitutional amendments. These are just laws that citizens can pass. So even if they pass, legislators can go in and change them. They are not enshrined in state law forever. They simply are just laws that are put into state law, and then a future legislature or a future citizens' initiative can go and change them.
Yeah. I mean, just a lot of time and effort just to have it kind of, like, you know, erased is kind of interesting. Yeah. Let's move on. Medicaid expansion. What's happening here?
Well, the Trump administration has signaled to states that they would allow them to impose caps on spending and some sort of work requirement if they were to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which is also known as Obamacare. That was one of the reasons why Utah was reluctant to do it in the future. They were afraid that they would be spending much more than they wanted to. There was no cap in sight, and they also wanted to put some requirements on top of that. So what they're planning on doing, Representative Spendlove has a bill that will expand Medicaid, not as much as the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act said you had to expand Medicaid to people at 138% of the federal poverty level. And that's in order to get a 90-10 split from the feds, where the feds pay 90% of that, and Utah would have to pay 10%. Right now, under traditional Medicaid, we're at a 70-30 split. In order to get that 90-10 split, you used to have to go to 138%. Representative Spendlove's bill would only go to 100% of the poverty level. It would place a cap on how much the state spends. They haven't determined that yet. And it would also impose a requirement for people who are able-bodied to either work or go through some job training in order to get those benefits. Those are some things that Utah lawmakers really want. He says it would expand Medicaid to about 60,000 Utahns, which is much lower than the over 120,000 Utahns who would probably get Medicaid under the full expansion of the Affordable Care Act. But this is much more palatable to Republicans up on the Hill. So they're going to try and push this thing through, and they say that they are confident that the Trump administration will give them some waivers they would need to in order to impose the caps and the work requirements.
Okay. Hey, Brian, I'm out of time. I've got to leave it there, but sure. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for your time this morning.
Okay.
Joining me now in the studio with a monthly update of our transit and transit plans, I've got Caroline Rodriguez from Summit County, Alfred Nantz from Park City, both transportation planners. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with this active transportation plan. What's this about? We've got a lot of stakeholders involved in this.
Yeah. In a nutshell, it's basically a plan looking at ways of traveling around the county other than in a vehicle. Active transportation, i.e. walking, biking, as the name implies. And there are quite a few stakeholders because it's a countywide plan. And because we want that pedestrian and bike access for lots of different entities.
So the school's just part of that?
Tell me who
else is involved in this.
Yeah, well, because the school is so important, obviously they're a big stakeholder in this plan. But also we've invited staff members from our various municipalities. We've invited members from the resorts. We've invited some large employers. And, we have a few levels of stakeholders, and that level is sort of a executive committee that's going to be reviewing documents. And then we are going to be having public input and a larger advisory committee where we will invite anyone who's interested in giving input or participating in the plan.
Yeah. So we've got, when we look at just the schools issue, we've got, of course, Kilby Road with mm-hmm. Ecker Hill, and then we've got 248 with the high school and
correct.
other school campus. So, is it one plan, or are we kind of delineating Park City, Summit County?
It is one plan, but it will concentrate on Park City within the municipal boundaries, and then Park City themselves may choose to build on that plan and get into a little bit finer grain of detail. And then we have sections for South Summit and North Summit, and then, the junction and in between.
So what's the timeline on this? We're going to have a plan?
Yeah, it's going to take at least a year, and we just kicked it off last month.
Okay. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about what some of those plan ideas would look like. Alfred, you're kind of following up on State Road 248 because we're talking about perhaps a new pedestrian overpass or underpass. We're talking about bike lane, bus lanes.
Correct. Those are corridor-wide projects, but we have broken out the two elements that you just described. The pedestrian bridge and or underpass will go separately from the 248 corridor project because it has independent utility and it can go a lot quicker, relatively speaking, in the transportation planning world. So we are looking at that right now. We're working with the school district on that. And that does feed into the broader 248 corridor project, which is right now under the environmental analysis. We haven't arrived at a preferred alternative for that. We're developing alternatives right now based on public input. We had a scoping period that concluded at the end of December, and that scoping summary report can be found on our website at our council minutes. So that does package up all the comments that we received from the public, and now we develop a purpose and need for the project, and then that helps drive the development of the alternatives. It's a very prescribed process through the NEPA process. But it will arrive at a preferred alternative, and then we're about 14 months out from that also. So,
14 months out from starting anything? Is that...
Correct. Even from identifying a preferred alternative, and then we identify what the right-of-way needs are and then what the final construction cost is also.
Yeah. So what are we considering? What are some of those alternatives?
Some of those are going to range from expansion of lanes. You have to have a broad range of alternatives. We can't have a predetermined alternative through the environmental process. So managed lanes, potentially reversible lanes, and then dedicated transit or high occupancy vehicle lanes also. And then you also evaluate the no build, no project alternative, and that's what you evaluate the alternatives against. If you don't do anything, what happens to that corridor in the planning horizon of 2040?
All right. So when we look at the overpass, underpass there at the cemetery, that can move faster than?
It can. Yeah. Like I said, relatively speaking. But we can go and advance that portion of the project with or without the corridor. That is an existing condition issue out there right now, both for safety reasons and for congestion issues. So we would look to advance that. But the plan that Caroline described is very important in the sense that UDOT won't even entertain any types of projects like this until you have an adopted plan. So we're evaluating even pedestrian and bicycle facilities on Deer Valley Drive also. But until we have a plan that shows that this has been vetted by the public, that it has a comprehensive connection. The plan, again, I know people think that we do a lot of plans and planning, but there is some method to the madness. And without having that plan, the UDOT won't even advance a project like that. We can't get funding through the federal government. So it's very important to have these types of documents that show that we have a comprehensive transportation network.
Yeah. Well, don't we have kind of a similar problem with Deer Valley Drive as we do out on 248? I mean, we've got a mountain on one side and then a creek on the other.
We do. And that's why you go through the environmental process. We identify what is the what's known as the LEDPA, the least environmentally damaging preferred alternative. And then that's how you get you arrive at at the project that meets the best objectives with the least environmental damage. So it is constrained. Yes, we know that. It could range from just having bike lanes on there to a full separated bike path.
Yeah. And so that's something that we're just looking at this point.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
And then over back to the Ecker Hill, the Kilby Road area, that's mm-hmm. since it's a county road, then that's a lot easier to make changes to.
Yes. But we still need a plan in place. And this will help us identify our path forward, especially as Derek Radke moves forward with potentially widening Kilby Road, to make room for that capacity there, and also for a potential park and ride location there.
Right. And again, that's what we're kind of talking about. Mm-hmm. There are just kind of bulb outs for right turns and yep. left turns, and as opposed to just adding,
Exactly. Exactly. Whatever's the most efficient for both vehicles and pedestrians and bikes.
Okay.
We want to accommodate all.
So let's talk about what we've heard from County Manager Tom Fisher is that we're going to go out and bond for $20 million for transportation and transit projects. Again, this is money that would be paid for with the sales tax increase that we saw.
That's correct.
So have we identified those projects?
Yep. So if you look in the staff report from Matt Levitt that is for this Wednesday, you'll see an itemized list of those projects. But to sum it up, they are capacity projects, capital projects that will be, one is the purchase of a park and ride facility. There's money to fund that Jeremy Interchange project, widening of Kilby Road, the 248 project is on there, and a few other in the longer term.
Okay. And of course, this is something that was passed majority, with people from Park City and the Snyderville Basin
yes.
that deal with the traffic. Are we got any plans for those people in the outlying area, like in Colville and Camas?
Sure. So for the bond, this only identifies the first 3 years of projects. So potentially there could be projects in those areas later on. But because we had to identify our short-term projects as part of our Let's Go Summit initiative, we want to tell people exactly what we were doing with the money. Those are the projects on the list at this point. And those projects still benefit people who live in Colville and Camas and other areas because a lot of them travel, they come to the Park City area for work or for shopping or for whatever.
Yeah. So the sales tax increase was expected to raise about $8 million per year mm-hmm, between mm-hmm. the two of them.
Right.
So we're going to then just bond for
yes.
3 years. So we get the money up front to do all of that and then pay that back over the next 3 years.
Exactly.
And then we would do something like that again. Is that how it works?
Or? That's how it works. I don't know that would be the plan. I think right now we're just focused on this one bond. And then, of course, we'll reexamine and see about the return on our investment and how the bond went and that type of thing.
Okay. Why not go for more?
I don't know the answer to that. Matt Levitt may know the answer to that, or, there are a lot of projects out there, so it could just be, we don't want to take out too much, in bond money.
Yeah. A bite at a time, I guess.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Anything Good. Else you guys wanted to mention?
I did have something I wanted to mention. Jenny sent me an email last night. We just want to remind everybody that Winterfest, is this Saturday from noon until 7:00, Lower Main Street from 7th. To 9th Street will close to traffic and parking starting at 8 a.m. On Friday through Sunday at noon. So, again, we're trying to be diligent about our events here. We had a very successful Sundance. We were joking. We don't want to put our guard down. We want to keep chipping away at our events here, making sure that everybody has a safe and accessible event. So use transit and carpool and then plan ahead.
That's just the Saturday, though, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, I do want to mention 248 inbound. It's a zipper merge. Let's make it friendly and easy to travel for everybody. You can use both of those travel lanes coming in. You don't have to get over to the left lane right away and then block everybody else from trying to get in. It works just like a ski lift. That's how you're supposed to do it. So if we all do it that way, it'll work a lot better.
It will.
Yes.
You still have the same number of cars on this on the road.
Yes, but when you have people speeding up to prevent someone else from merging, then everybody else is slamming on their brakes, and it's a compounding effect. So for friendly on the roads, it makes a bit of a difference.
People out there scowling, but yeah, okay. Hey, thanks. We'll
see you
next month.
Thank you.
The Park City Board of Education meeting tomorrow, starting in work session at 9 a.m. in the studio with a preview. I have the superintendent of schools, Amber Conley. Good morning.
Morning.
So first, we've got the swearing in of our new board member, Erin Grady. And we can do that in work session. It doesn't have to be a special regular meeting, huh?
Nope. We'll do the swearing in, and we have her oath of office ready to go. Excited to get her transitioned into Julie Eihausen's seat.
Yeah, and she's been kind of meeting with the board, so it's...
Yep, she's been at the last four board meetings. I know she's had lots of conversations with the board. In fact, Todd and I are meeting with her this week to go through just some programs, budget, et cetera.
Okay, so that means we're going to have three school board seats up for election, JJ, Ann, and Erin, who has to run for re-election.
That's correct. So we have three seats open.
Yeah, and that... people sign up for that starting as soon as March?
They do. I believe it's March 9th through the 15th. They have to go over to, I believe, Colville at the county seat and file. And depending on how many candidates put in for each seat, then we may need to have a primary.
All right. Let's see. We've got a budget discussion. Where are we at this point for next year's budget?
I would say a couple of big ideas that have changed this year. One is that we've sped up the budget process so that we can be able to hire during the best hiring season, which is starting right now all the way through the 1st of April. So what we've done is we've moved our budget cycle up and about 2 months, which has been a challenge for us administratively, just to be able to have the conversations, to have the documents, to have the narrative that goes along with that. But I would say also some big ideas around the budget. One is the request for positions falls along the line that there were many positions still from 2008 that were cut during the recession. And so many of the positions that you see, the paraprofessionals, the front office help, were positions that were actually cut that are now back on as requests. So there's one. The second part is that as we continue our professional learning community framework, the next part of the journey is interventions. And there is a heavy emphasis on interventionists for our ELL students, for special education, speech therapists, et cetera. And then I would say the third prong of the budget is the desire for administration and the board to focus on the whole child. So being safe, healthy, engaged, challenged, and supported.
So it sounds like we're spending just as much there as we are on teaching our kids, because we've got a budget asking for 7 new teachers, yet 10 and a half for our wellness program.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that I am extremely proud of is the work that we've put in around counseling, around mental health. And we're starting to see the benefits of that. You know, these are things that don't go reported, but we had our training with our Hope Squad, and the counselors were able to intervene the last couple of weeks with the child that had the means and the way and the plan for to commit suicide. And those are those things that you don't hear about, but the things that we need to make sure that we're continuing to support.
Yeah, so the superintendent of wellness, I mean, has he been able to get the systems in place? So that are we starting to see results?
You know, first of all, being a new position, I think that everyone has known that this was going to take a while to transition him in. The second part of that is that we have had an opening for a special education director that's been open since December that we've been unable to fill. And so he's had to take a large part of that load on. And so this first year, he definitely is holding his own. He's helped tremendously around putting in special education supports, but still a lot more is needed for him.
Yeah. We also had, well, we've got our existing curriculum director position open since Kathleen Einhorn is now at the high school. And then the current year budget had also budgeted a second curriculum director, a K-12 math science curriculum director, and a high school academic coach. So those still have yet to be filled.
Right. So I'll do a little explanation. So we've never, besides this last year, had added to the curriculum department. And if you look at the expectations and what we're doing academically for our children, I think that you can see that we have managed to do really great things. The idea, first of all, the Ed Foundation has supported for the last 3 years Charlie Matthews, who has been our STEM science curriculum writer, and the sixth grade through eighth grade science standards have changed, and they're now going into the high school. So there's some significant curriculum changes that are happening. So it would be us bringing him on into our maintenance and operation budget, which is pretty, I mean, that's pretty common. If we try things with the Ed Foundation, and then we typically, if it works, which it has, take a look at our science scores. We definitely have some of the highest science scores in the state comparatively nationally. It's working. So we do have that. The other one is looking at many of the programs that we're adding specifically for our early childhood learning, all-day kindergarten, our dyslexia initiative. Those things take a program manager, and so the idea then is to also have a K-12 curriculum director that oversees our academic coaches, helps with the interventionists, and then, of course, is directly under the associate superintendent of teaching and learning.
So that position, is it posted yet?
I'll have to check on that. I know for sure that our high school principal position is posted, and we have the dates set for interviews, which is March 7th. We're wanting to get that hired and start that transition to be able to have the success of the high school. I'll have to check on the other positions.
Yeah, Kathleen Einhorn, though, she leaves after.
So she's announced her retirement as of July the 31st of this year. She's agreed that, she will transition as much as she, possibly can. She has some other things lined up that she's wanting to do, and has given us that her word that she'll be able to transition someone.
And I also read that the district will be holding off the idea for 7 new assistant principals until your replacement is hired. How come?
You know, I think one of the things, again, that we've looked at with this budget is trying to solve a couple of big ideas, and that's the issue of time and the issue of process. When you talk to our teachers, our educators, every single issue is we don't have enough time. And so as we continue to look, the board needs to consider that in, another year after this, you're going to start negotiations again. And so how is the board going to solve the issues around time? Do we extend contract time for teachers? Do we reduce the school day? Because we're way above in minutes for our school day. So I'm sharing that with you just to prep you for what's coming. The other one is around process. And we have, had the human resource review. And one of the things that we know is as we brought in 26 new positions last year, the onboarding of those positions was really difficult for a team of two. We have our human resource analyst and we have Tim McConnell, our human resource director. And so the idea is, while we know that we need support in the schools administratively, we also have we would prefer to put the money closest to the children with our teachers. And then when the new superintendent is hired, if that's something that he or she desires, it would at least be in the forecast.
Okay. let's see. I wanted to check in with regard to the McPolin recess policy. Principal Edmiston had sent families a letter outlining the policy that third to fifth graders will have two recesses a day. What can you tell us the backstory on this? I mean, at one point they were just saying one recess.
Right. I might do the front story, and that is we've reinstated recess for our third through fifth grade. I would definitely encourage it. It was in an effort to have more instructional time rather than take away recess. And there is research around the idea, of course, that we need our brain breaks, we need physical activity, we need fresh air, which, of course, I'm a supporter of.
Yeah. Do all elementary schools have the same policy? I mean, or is that a principal decision?
You know what? Our principals have the autonomy to be able to set their schedules. We have very specific minutes around instructional time that we're required by the state, and I can get you those minutes. I don't know them off the top of my head. But besides that, then we have the principals are able to set the schedule. And it is dependent, of course, upon supervision and what's – and I always go back to what's best for students.
Right. So it wasn't a decision based on academics. It was a decision to reduce it based on behavior.
I think that there might be some communication in there that isn't correct. I think that that might be the storyline, that there was some behavior situations occur. If anyone's ever been on an elementary playground during recess, you know that there's behavior that's going to occur. It wasn't an effort, from what the information I've been given, is to be able to do some tier three, which is a triple dose of intervention for our students. So it was really around academics. But given, you know, given that there wasn't a bank of research around the why right now, before we and the board is looking at a policy to be able to designate how much time children have to be physically active.
OK. And then finally, just wanted to mention tonight there is a community meeting to talk about your replacement.
I am going to be really honest. I have been I have removed myself from the scheduling of that, so I'm unable to share that with you, Leslie.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Amber, hey, anything else you wanted to mention?
Nope. Just that we have a February break coming up, and in 2 weeks we have parent-teacher conferences this next week, so watch out for our little guys that are going to be out and about in a couple weeks.
Okay. Amber Conley, thanks for your
time
this morning. Again, the Board of Education will be hosting a community focus group tonight, 6:30 to 7:30 at the district office. The Board of Education offering you to give input on the desired characteristics and skills that you would like to see in our next superintendent. Joining me now in the studio, I have the CEO of U.S. Ski and Snowboard, Tiger Shaw. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
We're hoping that Tom Kelly can join us. Sounds like we've got some just cell phone issues going on.
Yeah, sounds like he's trying to get through, but he's on the beaten path over there, and he's trying to call through.
All right. He left last week, so he's had a couple of days on the ground. What have you heard from him?
He has. I know he said the venues are absolutely spectacular, and the Koreans have things incredibly well organized. There's been many, many different press conferences and a lot of prep going on with the media, and he's had a chance to see a bunch of our athletes, and we are all getting settled, getting ready, and he said things are ready to go.
Yeah. So do they have snow?
They do have quite a bit of snow. They're really good at making snow. They have a cold climate. It's down the single digits at night. Many of the events are at night, but things are looking great.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to visit?
I have. I've been there twice. And over the last two winters, they have had test events on all the venues. So athletically, it's going to be one of the best Olympics ever.
Yeah. And why do you say that? I mean, the South Koreans do things well. Yeah, we know that.
Well, really what happened in every Olympics, you know, you really have this army of expats that move around and are experts in all the venues. And as long as the Olympic committees hire them, then you end up with the very best venues possible. The Koreans have done that, and the outcome has been great.
Yeah. And as you recall, I mean, here during the Utah Olympics in 2002, of course, we had 9/11 happen just months before that. Given just all of the threats that North Korea has been making over the last several months, I mean, do you feel safe? I mean, do you feel like your athletes are protected?
We do. We're well prepared. The USOC is well prepared also. But the fact that that President Kim Jong-un has sent a delegation makes everybody really relaxed. And if you notice that security is not top of the news these days, and it certainly was leading up to it, so we're all feeling really, really good.
Yeah, and what we learned here in Utah was the whole mag and bag thing. I'm guessing it's just standard procedure at this point?
Security is super tight over there. The Koreans have a lot of their army involved and their police, and it's absolutely probably one of the safest places in the entire world right now.
Yeah, so when do you head over?
So I'm heading over in a couple of days. I'll be there in time for the opening ceremonies, which are on NBC here at 8 p.m. on Thursday night.
Yeah, now do you stay throughout or?
I'll stay there the whole time. I get to watch a lot of the events. We have many different programs going on. We use the time as a chance to meet with the IOC, the FIS, many of our counterparts from the other countries. It's really quite a series of events, but the best part is being at the venues and watching the athletes do their very best. So fingers crossed, knock on wood.
Yeah. Now, do you have like we saw here in Park City, kind of that U.S. Ski and Snowboard House that you do some hospitality and things like that?
Yes, and the USOC has a USA House, and we utilize that as much as we can, and visitors are allowed to go there. It's really spectacular because it's right at the base of the alpine events, and that's in the Alpensia area. That ski area is called Yongpyeong, and there are probably, boy, nearly half the events within 18 kilometers of there.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the athletes themselves.
Absolutely.
I guess the mogul skiers are there because they're, what, first up? Or
yeah, they're early on. They have arrived. They're getting ready. And most of our women's alpine team is flying from Europe today. And really, they kind of string in during this week, try to get used to the time change, which is really quite dramatic from here and from Europe. And, you know, we have an amazing Park City contingent over there, just a number of great athletes. Obviously, Ted Ligety and Megan McJames here from Park City in free skiing, Alex Hall, McRae Williams. In freestyle, Maddie Olson, cross country, Rosie Brennan, and Nordic combined and jumping, Will Rhodes, Sarah Henriksen, and Abby Ringquist. And Brian Fletcher and Taylor Fletcher live here and spend an awful lot of time here. They call Steamboat home. But if you broaden that ring a little bit to the Salt Lake City area, including Faye Galini and Border Cross, and Alex Hall, of course, from Salt Lake City, and then even Steamboat, it's just extraordinary what this region of the country has sent. Probably one of the strongest teams in the world. If you compared this area to the world's best, you would find we're probably the fifth or sixth best country. If Park City and the region was a country, we'd be ranked pretty high.
Wow, that's impressive. Let's talk just quickly about Megan McJames. I mean, here she's qualified for her third Olympic Games, and yet she's still not a member of Team USA. How come?
She is a member of Team USA, so that's the Olympic team. So the U.S. ski and snowboard teams, we have qualifying criteria, and if you make that criteria, you make it onto our teams. Now, the difference is really that you train by yourself or you train with other countries or you kind of scrap together whatever best training is possible. Megan actually trains an awful lot with us. She is not technically a named member of our team, but we support her considerably. And I know the region does also, and she's doing great. But we really are focused on athletes that are capable of making podiums. And so our criteria is based on that, and that's how we fill our teams.
Yeah, but then you look at somebody like Julia Mancuso, who hasn't been performing for years as well. And you think, you know, why is she still? She's no longer. But
She recently retired. Sure. So she was in that category of injury recovery. So if you're a national team athlete and you're injured, you are given enough time to recover and return to ski or ride and then return to competition. And if you don't make it, at least you've given it your very best shot. And she had done that. She's an extraordinary athlete, was a huge contributor to our team, won many medals. And in the end, it was the best thing for her to retire, and she was able to go out on her terms. It was wonderful.
Okay. So unfortunate about Steve Nyman.
Absolutely crushed me. And then Jackie Wiles also this weekend at the same venue in Garmisch-Partenkirchen in Germany. Unfortunately, speed downhill racing is not the safest sport in the world, and we do suffer career-ending and very rarely, but often season-ending injuries. And that happens. I mean, fortunately, about 8% of our team, that happens every year. But Steven was just coming back from a knee injury at that location exactly a year ago, was getting faster and faster. And it's the nature of the sport. You take your risks. You try to go that fast. I mean, a lot of people equate downhill racing to skiing from the top of the mountain at 90 miles an hour wearing basically your underwear. And it's a dangerous sport. But those who master it do great at it. We have one of the best teams in the world. And we try to mitigate risk as best we can.
Yeah, do we know the extent of Jackie's injuries?
I think she has a knee injury also. I'm not sure it's been fully diagnosed. I know she's on her way back here, but she has her season is over also, unfortunately. And she was incredibly fast. She was right behind Lindsay. And Breezy Johnson, who was healthy and going fast, was fourth and eighth this weekend, won the training run on Saturday. We have, I wouldn't even call them dark horses. I would call them bright horses that are going to surprise a few people, I think. And not just in Alpine. Our women's cross-country team is extraordinary. They've been podiuming right and left, top threes, winning events. I mean, it can go through the whole team and tell you stories about everybody.
Yeah, and Lindsey Vonn, of course, winning both downhills this weekend, just charging forward to
Exactly.
To being the best, the most winningest skier ever.
Exactly. And it's an ideal situation for her. She just totally crushed it this weekend. That was a very difficult course. Her competition was right on her heels, so she barely won. She was on the correct side of a few hundredths of a second, fortunately, Saturday and Sunday. Sometimes she can win by up to a second, and she's ready for Pyeongchang.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the snowboarders. Of course, Sean White back, and then Chloe Kim, who's
Yes, exactly. Extraordinary athletes in their own right. Sean, world-class athlete, as we know, for many Olympic cycles, and riding very well, which is awesome to see. And Chloe Kim, an up-and-comer, only 17 years old, couldn't go to the last games because she was too young. She's amazing, and she's the best in the world also. And they've been having great events lately. They've been riding well in the half pipe, and I'm super stoked to see how they do.
Okay, and then Gus Kenworthy, he has come out as a gay rider, and it's interesting. I mean, he seems so excited, and maybe just having that lifted from him in terms of just being able to be himself now.
Gus,
really excited.
He's an extraordinary athlete, and you know, his coming out was really an extraordinary story, and so many people supported him, and it's wonderful, and everybody embraces him equally, regardless of any particular attitude or persuasion or sexual orientation or political orientation, and we embrace all athletes. It's about athletics, and Gus is one of the greatest free skiers in the world, and again, an amazing personality and somebody to watch, and that's what's going to make watching these Olympic Games absolutely stunning.
And then, of course, we've got the cross-country athletes. It used to be that Team USA really didn't compete there, but we've got some pretty strong skiers, and we've seen that the last couple of seasons.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing what our women's team, you know, led by Keegan Randall. She was really the one that got out in front and showed that she can win. And the athletes that she brought behind her, Sadie Rosie, Sophie Caldwell, Jesse, of course, podium multiple times. We just have an extraordinary team. Liz Sargent. So they are, again, showing how powerful it can be when one athlete breaks through and really pulls them together. And the cross-country team is an extraordinary example of teamwork and a high-performance team. They are unbelievably supportive of each other.
Right. So, again, things kick off with the opening ceremony. Is it Thursday?
So Thursday night, 8 p.m., which is Friday in Pyeongchang County.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, we look forward to it. I know that we hope to get that cell phone reestablished with Tom Kelly. He'll be doing regular reports is our hope.
Yes, that'll be great. And we'll make sure the telecom works halfway around the world for next time.
Okay. Well, thanks for spending some time with us this morning, Tom.